Good afternoon. This is Ryan Scherer. Welcome you to Woodland Stars Radio. Here at Woodland Stars Radio, we believe that every human on the planet has the power to use their own thoughts to change events in the mundane world. This show is all about learning how to gain control of that creative process. So let's get started. My co-host today is Wambui Bahati. You've heard her on the show before. She's a singer-songwriter, many talents, has been on Broadway. And she is going to be doing a little something today that's going to be a twist. Hi, Wambui, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I do have to say I'm having a real hard time hearing you.
Well, I'll have to speak a heck of a lot louder.
Okay.
Hey, what do we got on the agenda today?
Well, today we're doing a little twist. I am going to be interviewing the host of the show. I'm going to be interviewing Nevin today.
That sounds interesting. Let's see if we get Nevin on here. Nevin, are you on here?
Oh, yeah. I'm sitting around waiting.
Well, as I'm sure you've heard, Wambui is going to be interviewing you today. You think you're ready for this?
Well, it's about time the old man sat in the hot seat. I think Don Newsom would like to see me in a hot seat.
Well, yeah, you're in the hot seat, and we're going to turn the heat all the way up today.
Oh, just wonderful. Listen, before we get started, I want to yell something at Don. Don, if you're listening, we need some more volume on Wambui. Her phone line is kind of weak. So if we can get some...
And I'm having trouble hearing everybody.
Wow,
okay,
that's much better now.
Much better. Very good. Now... Let's see, where were we? Okay, so I'm on a hot seat, and Wambui, I guess you're prepared with, you don't know anything about me, so I guess it's going to be a general interview, but I'm just waiting to see. So, Ryan, why don't you go ahead and turn the microphone over to Wambui, and let's get on with this interview.
I think that sounds great. She sent me a script of some of the questions and stuff, and I think she might know you better than you think. Well, Wambui, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Well, thank you so much. You know what? I've only known you guys for a really, really short time. And I just want to make sure, can you hear me at all?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. I've only known you for a really short time. I think, really, if we've known each other for less than 2 weeks. But I feel like we've known each other for a really long time. I feel like I've known you for a long time. And the more I get to know each of you, and the more we talk to each other, I find out how much we all have in common with each other. And I know, Ryan, the other day we realized we've done some of the same shows, and we have that theater interest thing in common.
Uh-huh.
And Nevin, I found out that another thing we have in common is that we're both ordained ministers through the Universal Life Church in Modesto. And not only are we ordained.
How did you come across that?
Well, you know, I have friends in high places.
You must have. What's really fascinating right now is my left-wing fanatic tree-hugging brother-in-law is listening to the show,
not only that, but we were ordained the exact same year, exactly 1 month apart.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating. Hey, maybe it's past life that we know each other,
perhaps
getting back together. That's kind of fascinating.
You know, and the other thing, okay, before I get into the heart of the interview, I just want to touch on this. I consider myself a free spirit, and I know that you do too, and I think, Ryan, I think a lot of people listening consider themselves free spirits. And before we get into the heart of the interview, I just wanted to get what your definition of a free spirit is. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
Okay.
My definition of a free spirit is an individual who is willing to travel through the universe without being tied down by any particular structure. That would be either a structure of religion, specifically religion, but it could also be other structures too, such as political orientation, lifestyle. A free spirit is an individual who, number one, is willing to risk, willing to enjoy the universe, loves themselves very much, and understands that most of what we see, hear, and feel is an illusion that we've created for ourselves for the purpose of entertainment. That's my definition.
Wow. Well, that pretty well says it. And so we're going to go on and talk to get to know this Fee Spirit, Nevin, and we're going to start right at the beginning because somebody told me that's always the best place to start. So, Nevin,
yeah.
Where and when were you born?
I was born in Newark, New Jersey,
really?
In 1943 on August the 16th. And the most fascinating part, and hey, sis, if you're listening, you'll love this. My sister and I were both born on August the 16th, 3 years apart. She always kind of resented that because she couldn't have her own birthday party.
That's kind of funny because my brother Tony and I are 5 years apart on April
29th. Wow!
I'm gonna apologize if that's okay because I'm really having a hard time hearing you. So I don't know if it's a matter of moving a microphone closer. I don't know if I'm probably the only one that's having a hard time.
Are you having a hard time hearing me, Wambooey?
I'm having a hard time. Yeah, both of you sound real far away.
Don, if you're listening, can you do something to help her out with on her end? I hear her fine.
Oh, you hear me fine? Maybe
I hear all of you fine.
I need a better phone. Well, we don't have telephones in common. That's one thing for sure. Okay, so Newark, New Jersey. So you were born right here in the New York area then?
Yes, Newark, New Jersey.
Okay, so I know that last year we talked a lot about what was going on in North Carolina during the 50s when I was born, and we talked about the racial climate a little bit. So can you just kind of fill us in on what was happening racially in Newark, New Jersey when you were a child and how that all filtered in?
I'm sorry to say I really don't know that much about it because I was raised in a small neighborhood, a very Italian neighborhood, and we had very few dealings outside of that neighborhood. In fact, the only thing that I ever knew is what went on, I'll say, within a 10-square-block area. And there, although I do, you're jogging my memory a little bit. I do know the neighborhoods were segregated, but I know that after the fact. However, there was one very odd thing about the neighborhood that I did live in. We, in fact, had a black family living probably, I don't know, maybe a block or two blocks away, and I think they were, like, there forever. And for some reason, they were the only black family in that Italian neighborhood. I can't even remember their name, but I used to play with the kids, and it was like they were there forever, but nobody ever really commented about them being a black family. And
okay.
20 years later that I realized that.
Well, I'm sure it was, I guess it was a different thing than the South. I know that it was a little different in the North than it was in the South during that period. So, I mean, did you go to integrated schools?
I went to a predominantly Catholic school. It was, and that Catholic school was St. Anne's, which was in a German neighborhood. And no, there were no blacks in class. And the only black person I ever saw was that one family. I mean, we really lived isolated.
Okay. So you went to a Catholic school. So I want to talk to you a little bit about what you were taught as a child or what you believed as a child about religion and how, did you bring any of those beliefs with you as an adult and how do you see them now?
That's a tough question. Well, to tell you the truth, no one actually ever discussed beliefs in school. What Catholic school was about was a lot of discipline, especially discipline of learning. And the only religion that ever actually came across was we had a class called catechism.
Uh-huh.
And in that, I really don't remember, but I think it occurred like on a daily basis for like 20 or 30 minutes in the classroom, and the nuns would teach out of what was called a catechism book. The strangest part about it is I didn't learn that much out of catechism, because most of what we were taught was kind of like interpretations of how people saw religion, how people getting to know who the man Jesus was, and so on and so forth. But it was all reinterpretation of the Bible, and in fact, back then, I don't know if it's true today, but back then in the 50s, the Catholic Church kind of discouraged people from reading the Bible directly.
Really?
I do not know why, but I do know it was discouraged.
Well, they keep the power all in one spot.
Probably.
After the Dark Ages, the 50s, they did start teaching more sending you home with the Bible. Actually, funny enough, I share the fact that I went to Catholic schools when I was younger with Nevin, and had catechism class and confirmation and First Communion and all that as well. But afterward, I know when I was going, which was would have been the early 80s, late 70s, they did teach and send home a Bible.
Well, the simple truth about my own belief system and Catholicism itself is that there was very little there. There was very little foundation. I mean, I did a lot of things ritually, like I would go to church, I would attend the sacrament meetings, and so on and so forth. But I had absolutely no idea what I was doing or why I was doing it. And I just simply followed along. Everything that I know about the Christian religion, I learned much later in life when I took it upon myself to read the Christian Bible. I've also read the Quran and a number of other religious texts. But the simple truth about Catholic schools is that back then, they didn't really teach about religion. They taught catechism, and that could have been whatever interpretation the nun or the people who wrote the books wanted to make.
Uh-huh. So you can't really say then that the ideas and your free spiritness today is a result of your making a conscious decision that because of the Catholic schools and religions and things that you were taught and subjected to as a child, you were like decided, made a conscious decision, okay, I'm not going to do that.
Well, maybe I shouldn't go that far. I did make a conscious decision in the sense that at a very particular point in time, I started in asking myself, what am I about? Who am I?
Okay.
And many of the things that I remembered from my childhood and from religion, they didn't make sense to me. There was no logic to it. And so I did make a conscious decision to say, I'm going to investigate this. And eventually, I wound up encountering material that opened a whole lot of other doors. I wasn't even aware the doors existed, let alone open them up.
Okay. So let's move on along then to by the time, when you were in high school and all of this, what were you about? What were you like as a young high school student? Or what were your interests? What did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
if you were to ask my brother-in-law that, he knew me at that age, he'd probably say a criminal. I had kind of a rough high school time. And the reason, part of the reason, is that my mother died when I was around 14 or 15 years old. I had just entered high school.
Uh-huh.
And she had died of Hodgkin's disease, which today is quite treatable. And it was a kind of a long, grueling death that she went through. I mean, the dying process for her was almost 5 years.
I just want to ask, did you have siblings?
Say that again?
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to know, as you're talking about this, I wanted the listening audience to know whether or not you had siblings as well.
Yes, my sister. Just her. It was just her and I. She's 3 years older than me, and when my mother died, she was just
turning 18 and trying to get started making her own life, the family kind of fell apart. My father took my mother's death really hard, and he kind of drank himself into a stupor for 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. I really had very little structure around me once my mother died. It was almost none. My sister made a lot of attempts to try to provide structure, but she was a young girl, and she had this, kind of wild brother on hands. She didn't know how to deal with him. Mm-hmm. And my high school years are really kind of a blur. they really are. I mean, there's not much there to recall. I did go out on dates. I had lots of girlfriends. I had friends all around me.
Uh-huh.
The sad part about it is I don't remember much of it.
Uh-huh.
I would suspect that the first year of my mother's death, as a high school student, I was probably in some very severe shock, emotional shock.
Right.
But, back then, people just didn't deal with it. I mean, you were just kind of, okay, well, that happened to you, now let's move on.
And nobody really believed in psychiatrists and all that stuff and therapy. As I remember as a child, no one ever really thought of that as anything that was useful. So how did you, with being... Sounds like you were kind of troubled as a teenager. How did you find your way into college or end up on that path?
That in itself, you could write a book on. but I'll start at the beginning. I had just turned 18, and I was pretty much confused. I mean, I had absolutely no idea of what to do. I remember that some friends of mine wanted me to take a trip with them to Alaska, and I really didn't want to do it. And my father always encouraged me to join the service. He had talked about it often. He himself had never been in the service, but he seemed like he wanted me to join the service. So for whatever reason, I one day... I
he didn't join, but he wanted you to join the service. Okay. Okay.
Well, one day, I just simply went down to the recruiting station. They were all lined up, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, and I just walked in one of the doors, which happened to be the Marine Corps.
Okay.
And I signed up, went into the service, and was out 9 months later, kind of like a childbirth.
Why were you out so soon?
Well, I had a... I had a terrible allergy to eggs.
Okay.
And when I was in the service, one of the last events that happened to me is we were getting ready to go over to Okinawa,
uh-huh.
And we were standing in line getting shots, and the shots that these vaccines were cultured in egg, and it pretty much put my lights out. I wound up in a naval hospital in San Diego. Not to make a long story short, they said I was too expensive to take care of, and so I got discharged. They gave me a choice. They said you could have an honorable discharge or a medical. And I actually called my father about that,
uh-huh.
And he advised do not take the medical because he believed that if I took the medical discharge, I might have trouble getting into the union that he was in. And at the time, he thought I would return home and eventually join that union. So I just
what union was that?
Pardon?
What union? What union was your father referring to?
I think it was steelworkers, but
okay.
I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, he was pretty sure that that's what would happen to me. But as it turned out, this is the beginning of a long process. I was discharged from San Diego, and as far as I was concerned at the time, I mean, I had no idea what to do. The service was going to be my life. I had no place else to go. I had called my father. He said, take the honorable discharge and come home. I really didn't want to go home. There was nothing there for me. On the way from San Diego, to New Jersey. I hopped on a bus, and I stopped in Utah to see some high school friends of mine who had gone on to college. Instead, these are the people that had gone on this Alaskan trip, and when they came back, they were going to go to college. Well, I knew that they went to Utah, and I looked them up. That was in, I think, around March of 1962, somewhere in there. Well, I didn't know anything about Utah, and the first thing that happened, I wound up at the wrong university. I wound up at the University of Utah in Salt Lake, and they were, in fact, at Utah State University in Logan, Utah. Anyway, I finally did find them. And, you know, it was quite a meeting. Here I was just out of the Marine Corps. These guys had spent almost a year now in college. And at the time, I was a pretty heavy drinker. And I was pretty drunk most every night. I mean, that was common for me back then. And I can't even tell you what that was a result of. I have no idea. But what happened is that it just happened that the day I arrived in Logan, Utah, my friends met me at the bus was the birthday of one of my friends. And they were going to have a party. So, of course, I joined in the party in one of the dormitories, and there was a lot of drinking and yelling and music, you name it, it went on. And again, I was pretty soused by the end of the night. Well, I woke up the next morning in the dormitory, in the kitchen, with my head jammed up against the garbage pail. And, I mean, I had absolutely no idea where I was.
Wow.
Well, these guys had known me from high school, and their sense of humor was a little strange. For a joke, what they did was they decided to take me over to what was called Old Main, and they were going to get me enrolled in college. The whole thing was a joke. I mean, I was still trying to sober up, and these guys are talking to me about enrolling in school, and I had no idea what they were talking about. But they were friends of mine, and, you know, I was young, and I trusted them. So, yeah, sure, let's do this. I'll walk over there with you. And I started catching on, you know, about halfway there that, you know, I mean, this just wasn't going to work. Well, we got over to Old Main, and, boy, I'll never forget. These guys, they walked right into Dean Carlisle's office. The secretary was there, and they were joking around. They were just young boys, you know. I mean, they were having a fun time at this jarhead's expense. And I started catching on, and, you know, I was laughing along with them. So they actually tried to make an appointment for me to see Dean Carlisle. Well, of course, the secretary, seeing the condition that I was in and what was going on, she made a lot of excuses, and I started backing out of the room. Well, apparently, Dean Carlisle was not even in the office. He was just coming in, and I backed myself right into him.
Oh.
I mean, I damn near knocked the man over. And, you know, and he was wondering what was going on and so on and so forth, but he was a very savvy man. I mean, he had been around college students a long time. And he looks at me, and he says, well, what's going on? And I said, we were talking about, you know, maybe going to college, but I kind of changed my mind. And so he looks at me, and he says, well, I haven't changed mine. I said, what do you mean? He says, I want to see you in my office. Well, I thought I was going to get reamed out, you know, first of all, being on campus. I was kind of half drunk. Well, this man starts talking to me seriously about going to college. And believe me, I was not college material. I mean, by no stretch of the imagination could you have considered me college material. I did terrible in high school. I was totally unfocused. But in high school, I really didn't care. Most of what went on in high school was kind of a blur. And so, I told him, I said, gee, I appreciate what you're saying, but first of all, there's not much to look at in the way of high school. I said, I have absolutely no money, and I wouldn't even know what to do in college. So he started asking me about what I was planning to do, and I had told him I had just gotten out of the service, so on and so forth. So he said, well, what if I found money for you to go to school? Would you go? I said, well, sure. I mean, I've got nothing else to do, and I like my friends here. Why not? Well, to make a long story short, he wound up being my advisor at the dean of the college.
Oh, wow.
As an advisor, because I couldn't be matriculated. I didn't have the grades or anything else. And I had to take the SAT test and so on and so forth. So my first year of college was spent under the supervision of Dean Carlisle. And what he said to me was that after a year, if I had done well, he would drop me as a supervisor and turn me over to a college as a matriculated
wow.
student. And, well, I did okay. And at the end of the year, you know, he called me into his office. He said, well, you're done with me. So he helped me pick a college, and he got me entered into it. And that's how I started my college career, all starting from one drunk night in a
dorm. I think that's
and many to follow, I'm sure.
but it gets better. How did you end up in developmental psychology?
Oh, that's
from
another...
a drunken night to developmental psychology.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people just love to ask me about, well, your psychology career and your interest in human behavior and so on and so forth. Well, I'll tell you how it happened. I thought I would go into art because I used to fool around with it a little bit when I was in high school. That didn't turn out so well for me, and so I was kind of looking around, and I found the anthropology department. And I fell in love with anthropology. I mean, I really, really enjoyed anthropology. There was also the psychology department there. Now, the problem was, after taking so many anthropology courses and so many psychology courses, I needed money to continue my education. And although I was working and so on and so forth at the time, I was cleaning toilets, by the way, on campus. My first 2 years of college, I didn't actually have a place to live. I used to sleep in the theater department. At one point, the theater department used to be in Old Main up on the third floor, and I used to sleep on the theater couches and things like that that they would use on the stage.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I let go of anthropology and went into psychology because there was some student money there for me. In other words, back in the 60s, there was a lot of money floating around, and I wound up getting small grants to continue my education in psychology, which I could not get in anthropology. And that's how I started psychology. It was an issue of money.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. So we're going to go on forward a little bit more to developmental psychology. And so, okay, well, tell us about leaving college then. Where were you at compared to where you, when you came in, you were obviously just this drunk kid.
Yeah, I was.
Somebody saw something in, saw the promise in you, saw your divinity. And so you became a developmental psychology. And not only that, but when you finished college, you went on to get your doctorate. Is that right?
Not quite. What happened?
Okay, then correct us.
I wound up graduating, and believe me, college was easy for me. And I don't know why the difference. You know, I mean, I look back at high school, which was like a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
I hated it. And to college, which was completely the opposite, maybe it was the freedom. I did very well in school. I was a good student, and I loved not only the learning, but the atmosphere around the college campus, you know, the constant chatter about new ideas and philosophy and so on and so forth. Well, I wound up getting a bachelor's degree, and I was in the psychology department, and one of my supervisors Dr. Glenn Castro said to me, well, you need to go on and get a master's degree if you want to go to work in the field of psychology. You have to have a master's degree in psychology back then to get any kind of work. And I said, well, what kind of work could I get? And he said, well, let's turn you into a school psychologist because I can get you a job pretty quick. So I said, fine by me. As long as by then I had just gotten married. I needed cash. My wife was pregnant. I said, yeah, I'll be a school psychologist. That sounds good. And
okay, wait. So you were married by the time you graduated college?
Yes. I had gotten married, in 1965.
What year in college were you when you got married?
I was a junior in college. I had just finished I had one more year to go when I got married.
And I'll
get into that whole marriage thing here in a minute, but let me finish out.
Okay, then. Okay.
My career in developmental started because I needed to go to work. I needed to make money. School psychology made money. It was an easy way to make money in psychology, you know, because all that was required was the master's degree. And so I went on and got my master's degree and took my first job, I think it was in 1967, in a school district in Idaho. And that was my kind of like my working introduction to being a psychologist. Well, I worked in two school districts. I worked for the school district in Idaho. Then I, again, to make more money, I left and went to Clark County School District in Las Vegas because they offered more money. Now, another strange thing happened. There I am in Las Vegas, and my wife is pregnant with our second child, and I was leaving the office one day, and I saw this notice on the bulletin board, and it said something about application for PhD, and that was at the University of Montana. And I pulled it off the wall. I looked at it, and I just kind of stuck it in my pocket and went home. And I showed it to my wife, and she said, well, according to what she knew, you would have to make many, many applications to get into a doctoral program. And she was right. Under normal circumstances, a person would usually send out quite a few applications, and you know, you get rejected so many times, and then finally maybe you make your way in. Well, I said to her, well, what the hell? Let me just fill the damn thing out. I tossed it in the mail. I totally forgot about it. I'll be damned, 2 or 3 months later, I get this letter back, and I've been accepted into a doctoral program. And, you know, I got to tell you, I was shocked. I mean, I was absolutely blown away. It was like, you know, at first I thought it was a joke. I only sent one application in. Well, I searched it out. I looked it up, and sure enough, but I wasn't at all prepared to go in that coming school year. So I traveled up to Montana, talked to them, and they delayed it for a full year because I needed to work one more year. And that's how I wound up in the doctoral program.
Wow.
So your career started out as one big joke.
and that's the way it was, Ryan, all the way through. Whatever, you know, whatever forces were pulling strings, you know, I'll be damned. I don't know if somebody on the other side of the veil was having a good time or what, but no matter what I did, it always worked. It didn't matter what I did. It didn't matter what happened. It was like, you know, I got to a point where I felt like I could just step right into the middle of traffic and a car wouldn't hit me.
You were charmed.
That's what it was like. I went on to that next year after working as the second school psychologist position, I started working in state hospitals. And my first state hospital, I didn't have my doctorate then. I was just an assessor. They needed someone who could do the testing. And I went to work for Blackfoot State Hospital. A friend of mine had called me up and said, gee, you know, you're off for the summer. You've been working in school district. Why don't you come up and work for me? He needed some testing done in the state hospital. And that's how I got involved in the clinical area of psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wound up moving on to Warm Springs State Hospital in Montana. And by then, the year is up, and there I am in Missoula, Montana, getting a PhD in developmental psychology. Now, why developmental? Because I had spent so much time with children in school districts, it seemed to make sense to me, and that's why I chose that. And I kind of liked being around kids. I did enjoy their company. I didn't particularly enjoy the adult problems, the adult clinical problems. But truthfully, I thought most of the people I wound up having to see, I felt that they were mainly adjustment problems, and if the people would just pick up their own bootstraps and get on with their life, they would have been fine. Whereas children are at a disadvantage. They don't have bootstraps that they can pull up. They are kind of like anyone's target. And maybe that's what attracted me to working with children. So I did. And I wound up working in many mental health centers. And the last mental health center I worked in was also back in Montana in Great Falls. But now let's get back to... I said I would get back to the whole marriage thing, and it's an important issue for me because it was a 29-year marriage. I met my wife in Logan. She was also in school. She was an art major. And I started dating, and we got married in 1965. I'm trying to think of the date. It escapes me right now. I know it was in April.
Now, is that the current wife you have now, or
No.
Previous, okay.
No, this is Jill is my second wife.
The previous wife.
My first wife, Elaine, and I, she was an art major. We were married for 29 years.
Now, I didn't do stuff I'd like for 29 years.
Well, you know... You know, to this day, you know, people say, you mean you get divorced after 29 years? Well, why bother? Well, the divorce occurred when I was around, I think I was around 50 years old. And my then wife, Elaine, had different interests than I. One of the things that you've heard about is the empty nest syndrome, where... You know, people kind of like, they grow together based on children, and our conversation was always about the kids. And so we functioned totally around the kids.
Right.
Well, what happens when the children leave? You know, my children turned 18. They left the home. They went on to make their own life. And Elaine and I were, we found ourselves not even knowing each other very well. We were kind of like strangers. We didn't know what to talk about. We had nothing in common except those children. I mean, absolutely nothing. It was about, I guess it was about the mid-80s when I was getting very restless and trying to figure out, you know, what did I want to be when I grow up, and I started investigating the existential questions, which frightened Elaine. It really did. She was, although she wasn't a particularly religious person, she did have a very firm set belief system, and I think she thought I was kind of like shaking the tree because I was investigating all these other things. Well, finally, after much discussion and consternation, we wound up getting divorced in, I think it was 1994, and that ended the 29-year marriage. Now, my wife, Jill, was a student of mine. I was back in the early 90s. I was working at Utah State University in the Child Development Center. But I also was teaching at another university in Ogden, Utah, Weber State University. And I just did that on the side. I used to teach off campus somewhere in a mall. They would find a room. They'd put a bunch of college kids in there. and I would teach them intro psych and things like that. Mainly what they were adults who were managing a family and a career and wanted to go on and get a college degree. And so the Weber State offered these off-campus classes. And so I wound up doing some teaching, and it was good money. Well, I met Jill in one of the classes that I was teaching, and it was right about the time that I was leaving the house and, you know, getting divorced and all that. Well, the divorce really took me kind of by surprise. I really never believed that that marriage would end in divorce. I really did. And I guess you might say I was at a point in my own life, I mean, with trying to understand what was happening to me, what was happening to my marriage, that I was getting pretty discouraged with life in general. And the only thing that I ever remembered that made me feel really good was when I had a new challenge in front of me, something totally unknown, where I didn't have any structure to fall back on. So I said, if this marriage is going to end, then so is everything else. I'm going to start over. And I walked away from my professional career.
I was going to ask you, I understand that 1994 is a very significant year for you. So is that 1994 is the year when this happened, when you walked away, when everything became new in your life?
Yes, it was in 1994. And I had this resolve in my own mind that I would start the entire process over again. Although I was discouraged with life, I was very self-confident, and I've always been self-confident, and I knew that no matter what life offered, I would be able to deal with it. And I wanted to develop something new, and I got to be very honest with you and the audience. I hated being a psychologist. I mean, I really did. There was nothing there that attracted me. You try listening to people's problems day in and day out, day in, day out.
Well, I'm married. I do.
I wanted to say to the clients, look, why don't you just call me in the morning instead of spending all this money coming to my office? Call me in the morning. I'll only charge you a little bit for 5 minutes of conversation and tell you what to do today. and that's the way I felt about it.
Leave me a message.
Yeah.
Well, I had some psychologists like you.
I had no desire to be a healer, a saver. I could have cared less. For me, it was money, and it made good money. But it was no way that I saw myself as some sort of, you know, healer of people. Believe me, I'm not. That was never me. Now, the odd part about it, the really strange part about it, is I was very good at what I did. Well, because I knew people, and I don't think that came from learning about psychology. That's just something about me that I picked up along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wasn't any big deal for me to walk away from that profession. It offered me absolutely nothing. I mean, it was dreary. It was extremely structured. And on top of everything else, most of what they said was a bunch of bullshit.
I just want to interject right here that because, you know, we did my interview last week and we know that I spent a lot of time with therapists and psychologists. And the fact that you were very good at because you liked people, and to me that is half the battle. That is practically the whole battle is about having somebody there who just really likes you. And that's basically what most people need is to know that there's somebody there that looks at them when they talk to them and et cetera.
I'm glad you brought that up. And I'm going to comment on what you said. Folks, what she just said is 110% correct. You do not need to go see a psychologist. You do not need to see a psychiatrist. You need to see someone who can demonstrate affection and concern for you.
You need a friend.
You need a friend. And all the psychological babble, all the bullshit you're going to read in textbooks, let me tell you, folks, and I'm not at all modest. I happen to be a very smart person. Most of it is bullshit what you're reading. We know a lot about white rats in a laboratory. We know very little about people. if you have a problem, if you're depressed, or if you're hallucinating, if you're delusional, if you're a drunk, if you're on drugs, what do you need? You need a friend. And now, let me give you a good example of this. If the psychology of the psychologists of the world were so damn good, why can't they make anybody better? Do you know that there is absolutely no evidence that psychotherapy works? That's true. There's no evidence that it actually works.
Something else that's real interesting too, Nevin, is recently I heard a recording of the guy who basically created the DMS. And how he talked about how they created the names for these diseases and how they decided what was a disease. And basically, it was a game that they were playing. In fact, they wanted to make racism a mental illness, but it became too complicated. And that's why it's not. But at the same time, being gay was a mental illness before 1973, and they decided to change that.
What Wambui is talking about is called the Diagnostic Statistics Manual, okay? It's called the DSM. I first went into psychology, the DSM, now this is the Diagnostic Manual, okay? We're gonna diagnose somebody. Well, the Diagnostic Manual is about 60 pages. That was the size of it. Each year, the damn thing tripled in size. Today we have volumes of the DSM. In other words, have people gotten crazier? No, folks, it's a game, just as you said. And what is the game about? I'm going to give it to you straight. It's about what's called third, listen carefully now, write this down, third-party payment. What does that mean? Insurance money. That's right. Psychology, psychiatry, most of these social workers, these are cottage industries that develop and make good money off of insurance. And it's all about the third-party payer, the insurance payer. That's why people go into these fields. That's what it's all about. Can they help you? Hell yes, accidentally. I mean, accidentally, Ryan will probably come across somebody tomorrow on his way home, and he will accidentally help somebody and not even know it.
That was yesterday at a gas station.
Oh, that was yesterday. Well, what I'm telling everybody out there. Oh, and we actually have some good anecdotal proof too of what does work. For instance, if you're heavy into alcohol, is a psychologist going to help you? Hell, no, they can't do a damn thing for you. But I tell you what will, AA. Now, isn't that strange? AA. And those types of organizations are the only ones who can actually demonstrate success.
Camaraderie.
Yes, you got it. It's called friendship, folks. Get a friend. You don't need to pay that money. I mean, all you're doing when you pay that weekly or monthly visit money, you're stroking your own ego. You know how you're doing it? Oh, I'm sick. I'm not responsible for my behavior. So you go see somebody to heal you. That's right, folks.
Yes,
you look at yourself as a victim. Instead of picking up your own bootstraps, tugging them on, lifting yourself up, and moving on. Most of us would rather be a victim. And how do we believe we're a victim? Well, hell, I must be a victim. I'm seeing a psychologist. He's telling me I'm nuts. So I got nothing to do with this. It's his responsibility now. That's what it was all about, Wambui. I was totally disgusted with everything that I saw. Now, did I do anything that I consider constructive? When I worked with children, I felt that the major role that I had was protecting them. That's right. It had nothing to do with psychotherapy, play therapy, or anything else, but just plain old protection as an advocate. And I was a damn good advocate. Any child that I was involved with, they wound up getting better. By me? No. It got better because I ripped the system apart and let it work for them. That's what I did. I was an advocate.
Which is another word for a friend.
Yes. Yeah. I was a friend. I could do things their parents couldn't do, and because of my status in the community and so on and so forth. But people, what you need is a friend. If you have a problem, you need to sit down and talk with someone.
Now, Wambu, I know you had a couple extra questions before we wrap this up.
Yeah, I don't know where we are with the time, but first of all, just real quick before we move on, because I think people want to know about your children today and your relationship with your children, where they are, and that's just real quick, and then we'll move on.
Okay.
Just,
I have two absolutely wonderful children. Diana, she was born in 1969 on September 20th, and she lives in Pocatello, Idaho. She has a wonderful job at Idaho State University. I talk to her quite a bit, and she's kind of a gabber like me, so she and I chat a lot.
Okay.
And my son lives just on the other side of the mountain from me in Nibley, Utah. A wonderful man. He does not have a college education, but I'll tell you, this man started out sweeping, as a young man, sweeping floors in a warehouse, and he worked himself up to actually supervisor of warehouses. He also worked, by the way, for Utah State University. Has a beautiful wife. I have two grandchildren from him. Oh, and my daughter is also married to Roger. And Roger, if you're listening, you're a great guy.
Is he the tree hugger?
My brother-in-law, my left-wing fanatic brother-in-law, is a tree hugger.
Oh, okay.
What's next on the list?
Okay, I want to ask you two more things. I want you to share with us. Last week you talked about your name. We that was another thing we had in common, is that we had changed our name.
Oh yes. Okay, folks, creating your own reality. Here's a 20-second, 30-second discourse on it. You want to change your own reality? You want to create your own reality? Well, damn it, don't bring a lot of old baggage to the new thing. One thing that carries a lot of baggage, folks, is your name. That name you were given at birth, and all the things, the good things and the bad things, all got tossed into that name. I decided I wanted a new life. I wanted to start fresh. I chose a name that I felt would lead me into the direction I would go in, and I would get rid of the old baggage by giving up that old name. And that's a darn good, if you did nothing else in creating your own reality, the simplest thing to do, find a role model. It could be someone in the movies, like John Wayne. Pick a model to act after and pick a name. I chose the name Nevin from a Catherine Kerr novel, who happened to be a shaman-type person in the novel, and the name Nevin meant no one. And what I was trying to do, folks, by the name of Nevin, is I was trying to find out who I am without the handle of a name. You know, can you answer that question, who are you without any of the external handles, like your name, your job, your role as a dad, as a boss, or whatever? That's what I was searching for, and the name Nevin provided that for me. It meant no one. And I could search to my heart's content.
One more thing, Nevin, before we go. I have one more thing I want to ask and get your ideas, get you to talk about this a little bit. This is it. I believe, people say I believe in conspiracy theory, but because I believe that we are too smart not to know how to fix so many of the things that are wrong in our society. And so I have to believe that a lot of things that go wrong by design. That I know a lot of people don't want to hear this, but on some level, somebody is keeping us from, you know, doing a lot of good stuff that we are capable of doing. And I just wanted to, you know, maybe you don't believe that, but I just wanted to get a response to that, or get your feeling about what's going on in the world today as far as that kind of thing.
As far as conspiracy, I would have to be a damn fool to think that everything that's going on is a coincidence. I'm not that stupid. I was born early, but not yesterday. I'm fully aware that the government, our government, and all governments manipulate to meet their own needs. There's only one purpose of government, and that is to continue to grow. Is there conspiracy? Of course. You'd have to be crazy to think that all this is just a one big accident. You know, I mean, now, do I believe in the conspiracy, let's say, of 9/11? Well, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I do know that there were some very strange things that occurred Like, how did all of a sudden we get up in the air so quick? Matter of fact, I just saw a show about it last night on the History Channel. Do I believe in the intensity of conspiracy as you might find on the net? Probably not. Because, I think I'm saying that because my own position about our government is most of the people are too damn stupid to actually keep things together that tightly. But I don't believe that the government itself are the conspirators. I do believe that there's a conspiracy among the corporate world. And I'm not talking about your local businessman. I'm talking about like people who belong to the Trilateral Commission.
Uh-huh.
I'm talking about the Rockefellers. Do they conspire to manipulate the masses, to keep you down, to have certain events occur like wars? Do they conspire to make war and feed both sides? Absolutely. I mean, if you really believe that we are in Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction, we're in Iraq for many reasons, but I guarantee you, the only reason we're there is because George Bush was going to make a lot of money on oil. It didn't work out so good for him. And it probably didn't work out so good for the Rockefellers. Yes, I do believe in conspiracy, but probably not to the level that you might find on the net.
Okay.
We've only got a couple minutes left, and Nevin, I have a question that came in off our website for you.
Okay.
It is from Patty G., and she says, "Hello, Nevin. I've been listening to your show. You have a very sexy voice. Are you involved with anyone?"
My wife is listening right now, and I'm about as involved as you can get. I am totally nuts over my wife. Believe me, sweetie, I appreciate what you're asking. But yes, I am very involved.
I thought that was a beautiful question. Now, you know what? Speaking of questions, I believe, Nevin, that you have a question to ask Wambui, do you not?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you reminded me. I almost forgot. Wambui, you did a nice job conducting the interview, and I really want to thank you for coming on the show today.
My pleasure.
I have a question for you, and you don't have to answer it right now if you don't want to. Would you be willing to be a co-host on Woodland Stars Radio?
Oh my God! I'm going to answer that. I'm going to call you and answer that. Right now, my inclination is to say this has been wonderful and I love it. And so, but what a way! My goodness, I'm almost speechless, which is real difficult for me, as you know.
Well, folks,
we've got one
minute left, actually. So we're going to have to wrap it up, and we'll continue this conversation off the air.
Okay.
But I would like to thank Nevin for giving us a good, honest interview, and I would like to thank Wambui also for being on the show. And with that, I'll say goodbye to you folks, and I'll hand it over to Wambui, and she can give comments, and she can hand it to Nevin, and we'll go from there.
Okay. I just want to say, first of all, thank you for allowing me to do this, what I think is a real important interview, and I've had such a good time. And like I said, I could go on. We're supposed to be wrapping up. Okay, we're wrapping up. Okay, thank you. So I'm going to just say thank you. It's been great. And so, Nevin, I'm going to give the last words to you.
Okay. Remember, don't close the connection, Wambui, because after Don closes the show, I want to continue our conversation.
Okay.
Folks, it's been great. I have 5:29 on my clock here. I would suspect that we're probably going to get an announcement pretty quick. It was a strange show for me. I believe it or not, I have never been interviewed. I have conducted hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews, including a serial killer and a mass murderer.
You heard it here, folks. First.
This really was a first, and it just plain has never happened before. And of course, Wambui, it was set up. You were set up. I wanted to know, you know, how things would work out. Would you be able to carry an interview? And, lady, you done good.
Oh, really? You know, I just got to get a better phone so I can hear.
Do we have any time left, or are we off the air?
Ladies and gentlemen, for Woodland Stars Radio, Ryan, Nevin, and Wambui,
you got
saying
it.
Thank you for listening. We love you.
Okay, we're done.
Okay. Wow.
All right. Okay. Wow, you have a tone going on your line, Wambui. That's incredible.
I'm going to either have the phone company come and check my line. And
oh, yeah.